Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, as you probably heard me say in several episodes, I think that the fundamental duty of the British government would be to get its house in order by taking care of the absolute basics. Now, for me, the absolute basics are energy and agriculture. I think I'm going to have to add birth rate to that. I'm not sure how I'm going to tackle that. Maybe I'll find some sort of breeder out there or something. I have found a farmer, but apparently he doesn't want to talk to me until November because of some harvest business or something like that. But I have found somebody I can talk to about energy. Now, obviously, nuclear is the only sensible option, and I happened to bump into a nuclear engineer type person the other day. So welcome to Brokenomics, an Englishman outside of time. Hello.
Hello. It's nice to talk to you.
Yes, absolutely. Good to see you again, sir. So what's your sort of general background, and what kind of industry are you working in, your sort of projects and stuff?
My general background is I'm an engineer, mechanical design engineer specifically. I've worked in the nuclear industry now for around about 4 years, roughly, I think. Yeah, so basically I saw it literally just before COVID sort of hit. So yeah, it was interesting to see that sort of the way the office changed so rapidly over the just such a short period of time to go from actual office work into working remotely, which is what... quite a lot of my colleagues do, because I work specifically for a consultancy firm rather than directly on nuclear sites, if that makes sense. So I'm kind of more in the background in the design aspect.
Good, because I've got a nuclear design I want to share with you before too long. Okay, so and what type of nuclear reactors are you working on? Because I understand that these days, well, there's the big ones that occasionally blow up, but not too often, but occasionally. Then you've got these small modular reactors, which apparently is going to be the next big thing. And I've even heard of like these nano ones, which are you know, quite small, but you know, could be used on a factory or something. So what kind of stuff are you working on?
Yep. Specifically, I've worked on a couple of different styles of reactors. So I've worked on let's think how to phrase this without dropping myself in it.
Big ones, medium ones, or the nano ones?
I've worked on the medium ones, and I've worked on nuclear fusion as well. So I've worked on the UK side of nuclear fusion, which is UK SMR. No, wait, that's small nodule reactor. It's UK. It's through UK AEA, and I can't remember the name. It's a spherical tokamak that they're doing. It's a sort of new design compared to the older forms of tokamak, because the older forms of tokamak are kind of shaped more like a donut. So the design that the UK has gone for is kind of more shaped like an orange.
Right.
That's the easiest way to put it.
So did you say fusion? Do we actually have fusion? Because I thought everything was fission at the moment.
Everything in terms of actual power generation and production is fission at the minute. It's all... Okay. Still purely fission. Fusion is kind of it's forever been 40 years and coming kind of thing, and yes. I think a lot of people even within industry still agree it is still 40 years away, so to speak.
Right, and so why is there such interest in moving up from fission to fusion? What would be the benefit there?
Multiple fold. One of the main ones is that for obviously with fission you get a lot of nasty things come out at the end of it that they're not too difficult to deal with, to be fair. You basically just dig a hole and throw them in the hole. Kind of right. Forget about them.
Okay. But could be a problem if you live next to the hole, but I see your point.
Yeah, exactly. But which is why they tend to put the holes far away from anyone. It's like, I think there's one up in like Sweden in the middle of the mountains and things like that. But yeah, the main benefit is it for nuclear fission, you've got a finite amount of fuel. So for all it's not going to run out within the next, like, you know, it'll be the next 200 years, it's spent all the nuclear fuel, basically. Or at least for the type of reactors that we use right now. The benefits of fusion are you have basically an unlimited fuel source for it.
Well, you could just use seawater or, badgers or whatever it is you want.
It basically what it is it becomes a self-sustaining reaction that generates its own fuel source, because what it uses for fusion rather than fission is it uses tritium. So it's literally right on the absolute opposite end where nuclear fission is banging heavy, really, really heavy elements together to make a fission reaction. And fusion is the exact opposite. It's banging really, really light elements together to make a nuclear reaction. Which again, it's a difference. it's the difference between sort of the atom bomb and the sun. So the sun works on nuclear fusion rather than fission.
Ah, okay. Right.
It's the Spider-Man plot. It's the Spider-Man plot of we want to harness the power of the sun.
That was Superman, wasn't it?
Doc Octavius, I think. Spider-Man 2.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I'm not up on my comics, so I couldn't be getting that one.
It's fine. But I can tell you one of the other main
benefits. Yeah, go ahead.
The other main benefit is the safety side of things. Everyone immediately, as soon as you mention nuclear, the mind immediately springs to Chernobyl. Everything could go wrong. It could go bang and we all die. That's what everyone immediately thinks when they think of nuclear. The beauty of fusion reactions, and with fusion as a energy generation concept, is if it goes that catastrophically wrong, all that happens is it just fizzles out.
Right. So it's not like fusion bombs are a lot more powerful than fission bombs.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
So why is it that you can have a fusion plant go wrong and it's fine, but that's less the case historically with fission?
Basically, what happens when plants explode is they have an uncontrolled chain reaction. So all your heavy elements continue banging against each other, creating more and more, and they just build up and build up and build up until they explode. With fusion, because everything's lighter, it's not a continually sustained chain reaction. It basically just, as soon as you remove the forces that you're implying onto the elements to make them smash together and come together, it just stops. It just fizzles out.
Okay.
It's like when you see some of the numbers, it's crazy numbers, because it's like the fusion reactors that we have on Earth are running at 100 million degrees Celsius, so like several times hotter than the center of the sun. Which, when you see the numbers, you kind of like freak out and go, ooh, surely that could go very wrong. It's like, no, because it's contained within this space, and even if everything fails and it goes wrong, it literally just kills itself and just cuts out.
And presumably generates an awful lot more power.
Theoretically, yes. The main problem with it is they're having quite a lot of time actually pulling power from the reaction itself. Because part of it is it's economy of scale to some degrees, because it takes an awful lot of energy to maintain that fusion reaction that you don't need for the fission reaction to the same degree. Because with it being a self-sustained reaction and a chain reaction, you just kind of put it in there and away it goes. Whereas with fusion, you've got to continually keep prodding it to keep it going.
A bit more engineering involved. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So that makes perfect sense. So I understand why we want to move towards that, but we're nowhere near it at the moment. Well, we're not close at the moment.
We're not 100 miles away, but we're not anywhere near it being.
Yes. It's not touching distance.
Yeah, it's not touching distance. It's like we actually in the UK have one of the experimental reactors that can conduct a fusion reaction, which is the Jet Taurus down in Oxford, I believe.
Right. Okay. So, but for now, I suppose what I probably want to focus. How are you on the medium sized ones? The small modular reactors.
The small modular reactors are coming along quite nicely, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
The basically a case of the idea of the small modular reactor is you take what was essentially every single bit of nuclear knowledge that we had in the past, and you try to modularize it, because the main problem with all of our prior nuclear plants is they were all completely and utterly 100% bespoke. So every single design aspect of it was a case of it has been designed for this plant, and then you go to another plant and you've got the exact same operation being carried out by a completely different part that is totally not interchangeable in any way, shape, and or form with any other plant. Mm-hmm. So you've got no way to sort of like scale it up, so to speak.
Well, and the economics of that, of course, is really bad. I mean, if I went and bought a car, but it was specifically made for me, it would be a hell of a lot more expensive than me buying one that's just rolled off a production line. So it's the same.
Exactly.
Okay, right. So before we get too deep into this, let's just make sure that we understand what a nuclear reactor is. Now, I've been having a think about this, and I think that I can build a nuclear reactor in my back garden. So you tell me if I've got this right. So basically, I take a big steel plate, and I wield onto that a big steel pipe, and I put a bit of water in the bottom, and I drop a bit of uranium in it into the water. That will make the water hot, And then I can stick a fan at the top, and it will basically run the motor backwards and supply power out of it. So I may have skipped one or two safety steps in there, and I don't want to turn this into a bloody health and safety channel, but basic principles, it's boiling water with uranium,
yeah,
and then spinning something, and then that goes through a motor. Have I got that right?
Yeah, it's basically that is the principle of just about every single means of energy generation that we've got. It's just we're coming up with different ways to heat up a kettle, basically.
Right. Okay.
That is all that a power station is.
And on
that note, actually, yeah. In your backyard, there was actually a case of an American Boy Scout that did exactly that. He went around and got a load of, I think he made a fast reactor, it was, but he was basically getting all of the little bits of radioactive material from fire alarms, fire detectors, and just he had a boatload of that, and he just stuck it into a reactor and managed to irradiate his shed. To the point where I think the government kind of got involved and went, ooh, what are you doing there? Can you not
well,
do that?
Yeah, that's the one thing that's holding me back from doing this in my own back garden, because I can imagine the man from the council turning up with his clipboard and looking very austere. So let's say I build my nuclear reactor in the garden, you come around for a barbecue and you have a look at it, and presumably you're mildly impressed that I managed to get hold of uranium or whatever it was. What have I missed in my design? How do I, without making this too health and safety conscious, what do I need to add to that? Because, I mean, okay, I'm using a fan. I should probably use a steam turbine.
Yes, but you'd want a steam turbine.
Yeah. Well, yes. So, I probably want a bit of containment and maybe control rods and dual water systems. Take my design from that level to something that's, you know, proper, professional.
That'd be quite a challenge. The main challenge that you would have for one in your own backyard is that basically.
How would you do when you're doing this properly? You got a pot of boiling water, and what do you take it from there?
It's a strange one, because one of the things that does surprise most people is there's not everyone that works on nuclear understands exactly how the entire power plant works. You have a specific area that you're responsible for that you need to know how it works. And then there's someone sort of at the top level that has a vague idea how all of these systems come together and mesh. Okay. So one of the ones that's quite interesting is if you were to try to do it in your backyard, you would need a running water source, which is what you need for just about every single power plant. You need a running water source to go by, because you need something to produce the steam for you.
Yes.
So what they tend to do is if you look at the locations of most of your power plants, they tend to be situated on either a river or by the sea, and they take the cooling water in literally directly from either the river or the sea.
Yes, I had been thinking of using the garden hose, but I would get into difficulties if for whatever reason the water, well, there's a hose pipe ban or something.
Yes.
So I understand. I've kind of skipped containment, because eventually I'd end up with just a very irradiated metal pipe. So there should be lots of lead in there and concrete.
Yes, you'd have things like that in there to stop the radiation from leaking out. And one of the interesting things actually is that you actually have on containment specifically, your nuclear power plants are incredibly heavily regulated and restricted as to how much emissions are allowed to let out.
Yes.
So it's to the point where your average coal power plant will actually kick out more radioactive waste than a nuclear power plant into the atmosphere, just uncontrolled emissions. Because obviously when you burn things, you create radioactive isotopes.
Yes. Yes. And the regulation is very light on that. And actually another bizarre thing I found, because you know, you mentioned the safety aspect of nuclear. One of the things I discovered looking into this is that actually more people die on solar per megawatt generated than they do on nuclear. Because actually nuclear actually has a surprisingly low number of deaths, even with a couple of catastrophes behind it.
You can throw the atomic bombs in and it still comes in the top three per megawatt hour generated because of how much energy is being produced and how safe your power plants generally are. Like there's a couple of stories I know of people dying on actual nuclear sites. One of them was just people just carrying out, it's not like the, you know, they walked into the reactor and they just got radiated and died. It's not something like that. It's literally just like things that you would get happen in any walk of sort of industrial life. Like it's people slipping and falling from heights. It's things like that.
Well, that's why the deaths on solar and wind are actually quite high because solar, you're on a roof and they're high and people fall off. And obviously wind turbines, they're very, very high and people have to go up them all the time for maintenance. Yep. And every so often somebody falls off. So actually the death count for solar and wind is just massively higher than...
It's higher than people expect.
Yes. Okay. So the other thing I wanted to clear up. So now we've established how nuclear works. the other thing I wanted to get to, and I wanted to put this in scale, is tell me if I've got this right. So I've got the bands of energy generated. So let's start with a watt. Very low amount of energy. I might be able to run a small digital clock, maybe.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
Okay. Then you go up to and then it basically goes up in jumps of 1,000. So a kilowatt is 1,000 watts. Now, I've got a solar system that can give me on a sunny day 4 kilowatts, and that's enough to run a home and charge a battery and all that kind of. And once I've got a kilowatt, I can do something useful, like run a microwave or all my fridge freezers and my LED lighting or the oven or something like that. So a kilowatt is kind of a useful scale at the home level.
Yep.
Right. Then we go into megawatts, and that's a million watts. So again, a jump of 1,000. Now megawatts, that's the range of sort of power stations, isn't it? They're like the small modular reactors.
Yep.
And if I've got this right, I mean, you correct me, but what we're looking at for these small modular reactors, which is, you know, the new big thing, is somewhere between like 30 and 100, maybe 300 per unit.
I believe the exact target they're aiming for is roughly 300 megawatts, but I don't know whether they'll specifically hit that. It's the aim of your small modular reactor is it's going to power a small to medium sized town.
And I think 300 would definitely give you that.
Yeah.
If the sums that I've got later on are correct. And then you go up by another unit of 1,000 and you get to the gigawatt range.
Yeah.
Right. Now, this is interesting because I have a look at the national grid line.
That's where you're going to country sized.
Yes. So apparently at this precise moment, the UK is demanding 33 gigawatts. We are generating 31 of that, meaning we're getting 2 gigawatts from...
Is that 30 or 3 point?
So 33 is the demand, and we're generating 31.
Right.
So we've got a gap of 2 gigawatts that we're currently getting in from elsewhere, which I don't really like, because if you're dependent on
elsewhere,
you know, somebody else,
well,
they can hold you to ransom on that. That doesn't seem good.
They can, but to some degree they'll be able to hold you to ransom anyway, because the place that's most likely coming from will be France. And France actually owns, I believe it is, pretty much all of the nuclear reactors in the UK, in part or in full.
Mm.
Like, I believe that, I think...
Well, the new one, whatever that is, Hinkley Point?
Hinkley Point C and Sizewell C. I believe that the EDF is in, at least, owns a chunk of both of them.
Yes.
And there was a bit more complication with them, because I believe that the Chinese were also involved in the construction, and they were going to be partially owning those as well. And the Americans stepped in and said, no, we've put a ban on them as a company. You can't work with them because they've stolen nuclear secrets.
Well, yes, I can understand their point there. So, but at the moment, actually, let's have a look at the national grid life. How much are we getting from nuclear? We're getting just under 5 gigawatts. From nuclear, so we've got we're getting a decent chunk out of the 35 out of 33.
Yeah.
But what I read was, and let me just check my notes here. Apparently, the UK government has said that they want to get to something like where did I put it? They want to generate an awful lot of energy from SMRs. What are they saying?
My main question for the UK government would be, when exactly? Because you can't just...
24. Spring...
When?
They want to get 24 gigawatts of nuclear energy by 2050. So 24...
That's achievable.
That's most of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's most of it now, but it depends on which way they intend on the economy going as to how much they're going to need. Because if they continue insisting on deindustrializing everything, they probably won't even need that much.
Yes, well, I mean, but the thing is, if you don't want to deindustrialize, what you want is cheap energy.
Yes, which is true. You do want cheap energy, yeah. But my main concern, especially for looking at the future, is you've got a grand total of 9 reactors. There's 9 nuclear reactors in the UK right now that are operating. Of those 9, I believe there is at least, I think it's 4 of them that are set to close by 2026. That's when their decommissioning dates are set for. And then the other 5, I believe, are all due to be decommissioned by 2030, or roughly thereabouts. Okay. So Sizewell C and Hinkley Point C are both not due to be built until after 2030. So you're going to have this gap where they have the choice of, do we extend the plant life of these existing plants, which I think... I haven't visited some power plants before. There's some funny things with regulations whereby basically there's certain safety protocols and procedures that kind of get stepped over, kind of the exact same way that when they introduced the seatbelt, they decided, oh, every new car needs a seatbelt. However, if your car's built before this point, don't worry about it. It's fine. So that was one thing that did genuinely shock me, is that you can go to a power plant and you'll see things that you think, that doesn't look very safe. And it's the response from the people working on site is, we've done it this way forever, and there is a cutout in the law for us to be able to continue doing it this way.
Yes, okay. So they're really going to need to get motoring with these small modular reactors, if that's the thing, especially if they want 24 yes. gigabytes, which is, it's most gigabytes. Of our energy. Yeah. And then we're going to get there by 2050. Now, if I understand how these things should work, basically, a lot of it is basically just made in a factory somewhere.
Yep.
So you need to prepare your site. The site doesn't actually need to be that big. I mean, it would fit in, you know, your local park of your town. You know, it's maybe 10 acres, yep. something like that. And basically, it's just a, you know, a building with a hole in it, and then a lorry turns up with a reactor and a few other bits, and basically all slots in. And
yeah,
so
it's big Lego bits.
Yes,
it's a Lego build it yourself. You can react.
So if you can get a main factory, you know, churning these things out, it yeah. actually becomes viable to have hundreds of them spread yeah. across the country.
The only thing that will probably be a limiting factor will be government red tape, because yes. right now the main thing that they look at when they're looking at putting a new nuclear plant in is they look at pre-existing sites, because you've got to have so much paperwork done before you can just drop a nuclear plant in there. But there is several sites that previously did house nuclear site plants that would be able to have the plants dropped into them. And this is also part of the concern with the decommissioning. Once you've started the decommissioning process, your site lease can lapse. So there's probably yeah. quite a few plants at this point where they would have made a good place to put a nuclear plant, but there's no nuclear activity going on there, so it would be a lot more paperwork. So it makes more sense to try to build it and continue okay. sort of rolling forward, which is why you've got both Hinkley Point C and Sizewell C are both, there's 2 pre-existing nuclear plants on both those sites. And they've been there since, I think, since roughly the 50s, I think. Even 50s or 60s.
Yes.
Yeah, they just keep building plants in the same place.
So that was the biggest hurdle I found when looking into this. It is all of the red tape. However, and not that I want to make government sound like a smaller problem than it is, because it is the existential threat to our species at this point. But it is ultimately a decision. So we could... I kind of want to focus more on the what's actually possible with good governance, because
if you want to go down,
could be swept aside.
If you want to go down the route of governance being a problem, there is yeah. a company called Nucleo, which I believe they wanted to do. They've got their own form of SMR, which they want to move forward with. And I yeah. believe that it's based on a lead form. It's lead and plutonium, I think, is what it uses. And we as a nation have a shed load of plutonium just sitting around in storage. And okay. this company, Nucleo, approached the British government and said, well, this material that you have sat there is actually a liability for you, because if ne'er-do-wells were to get a hold of it, they wouldn't need very much of it to create an awful lot of problems.
Yes. Well, and also, if we insist on you know, provoking places like Russia, if they were to drop a missile on the top of it, I presume that would be bad.
Yes, it wouldn't be good. Yeah. And basically, so this company, Nucleo, had approached the UK government and said, well, you have this material that is a liability for you, but we have a use for it, and we can take it and use it in our nuclear plants that we want to build. And the government basically turned around and said, not interested, go away. And so Nucleo has moved their company headquarters from London to Paris, because the French have said, oh, yes, we'll quite happily have that. Please do come.
Right. Yes. Okay. Yes. But on the red tape issue, I mean, they managed to clear away all sorts of planning and regulatory challenges to get up vast amounts of wind and solar. So when they want to make a change and when they want to expedite something, actually they can. And I'm thinking of, you know, another example would be Germany. I mean, they shut down their nuclear reactors, of course.
Madness.
And then having decided to do that, they then went all in on Russian gas. They then decided to
lose a pipeline,
stop using Russian gas. And so they found themselves in the situation where they just simply couldn't generate the energy, and they needed to get their coal power stations back online. And they basically just, you know, at the wave of a hand, got rid of all of the regulations so that they could expeditedly get things back. And they had power plants back within a few months.
Yeah. To be fair, I'm quite happy that they went down the route of using coal directly rather than importing it in the form of solar panels, for instance. Because one of the things most people don't realize is solar panels are actually manufactured using coal. Quite a bit of it.
Oh, okay.
Each solar panel, I believe, if you go out and try to find out the exact figures, it's quite woolly to find out the exact figures.
Yes.
But the rough figures that you can find will tell you it's around about 4 to 8 tons of coal, roughly. And that's the sort of finger in the air, this is what we think it roughly is, because the thing with it is most of your manufacturing of solar panels, I think 80% of it is done in China.
Yeah.
And China really doesn't care about all of the green initiative stuff that we have. So they literally just burn a load of coal, one, for energy, and two, the actual manufacturing process of solar panels requires metallurgic silicon. And the way you get that is you stick it in an arc furnace with a lump of coal and burn them together. And so one of the main ways that they manufacture one of the main materials for your solar panels is by burning coal.
So, okay. And so was that 4 to 8 tons for how
one
many
panel.
For one panel?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Okay, good, because I've got 15 panels on the roof, so that's quite a lot of coal that I'm responsible for.
Yeah.
Which cheers me up immensely.
Exactly. This is my one. That's been one of my main confusions with the whole green thing.
Yes.
Part of me thinks that the government doesn't seem to care about having continuous certain power. They don't care if the grid drops out occasionally. I think that they are going down the lines of, we just need intermittent power so that we can continue talking to people when we need to.
Right. Yes. I mean, I didn't buy it because I'm trying to save the planet. I mean, obviously, but
it's independence.
Yeah, it's independence. I mean, that's what it is. And what pushed me over the edge was, COVID era. I think it was Gavin Newsom in California. And at one point he was threatening to cut off the electricity supply to anyone who wasn't vaxxed. And I thought, right, OK, I'm getting solar panels. I'm getting a battery because, I mean, it will help me in two scenarios. One, if the government ever decides to mess with me by threatening me that we'll cut off the electricity.
Yeah.
And two, you know, zombie apocalypse, which is, you know, it's the sort of thing I think about. What am I going to do in the zombie apocalypse? So it gives you that level of independence. It's especially helpful if you're sort of away. But I appreciate it's not cost effective.
Yeah. It doesn't need to be cost effective. The way to look at things like solar panels is to look at them purely as a form of independence. It's energy independence from the grid.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.